Good evening, I guess, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us for another one of our Breakdown Weekly Roundups. It has been an absolutely intense week in the world of Alberta politics, particularly with the UCP AGM that went on this weekend. And we're going to talk a little bit about that because we have a couple of different perspectives that we're going to share. So we have our regular co-host, Sarah, who is a PR professional, a politico from all levels of government. And she's going to join us because she has, as much as we here at The Breakdown have our own little story to tell about the UCP AGM, Sarah is also somebody who works with another podcast called The Women of AB Poly. And she went to attend the UCP AGM and had a not entirely dissimilar experience than what we had. But before we get into Sarah's story, I just want to go through real quick sort of what the week saw for us here at The Breakdown to provide a little bit of context, because there's been quite a bit of speculation. So we just kind of want to set the record straight right out of the gates. So we had entertained the idea for a little while of attending the UCP AGM and just sort of doing the standard color commentary that we do. But obviously, we are not journalists. We don't pretend to be journalists. So we would not be able to attend the UCP AGM using the idea of us as journalists. So instead, the only option that would have been available to us was to go as observers. Now, for anyone who doesn't know, those observer tickets were not cheap at all. They were $999. And as much as we have a fairly loyal Patreon group that backs us up, that would have been about 4 months worth of our Patreon. And we have other things that we're spending that money on, including equipment and hosting and all of that sort of thing. So it was just out of our reach. So we kind of let that idea go. But there were some folks in the AB Poly Twitter realm who decided that they really wanted to see the Breakdown's voice at the UCP AGM. So on Wednesday, there was an initiative decided to crowdfund a observer ticket for the UCP AGM for us. And it happened incredibly quick. It was about 2.5 hours from the moment that the GoFundMe launched to the moment where we actually, I can't even take any credit. They were able to raise all of the funds for us to attend. We did buy a ticket. We had the receipt for that ticket. We had the confirmation of that ticket. And the next morning, we got a notification from the UCP that they had closed the observer ticket sales, despite the fact that that was not posted anywhere. And people have gone through their web caches, and there was no record of the observer tickets not being available for sale. So it was a bit of a surprise, but they did refund the money. And so we went and we hung out with some of the protesters on Friday, who are the peaceful protesters. And it's really important to me that I make that very clear. We were there with the peaceful protesters who were concerned about coal mining. They were concerned about democratic principles. These were not the anti-masker protesters. We actually left deliberately before they arrived there because we didn't want to have anything to do with them. But we did have a great conversation with Dave Kahn, and that was released as a mini episode. But it was quite a bit of a very interesting 24, 48 hours. We did get the refund back, and we've got part of the refund back. There's a processing time thing that apparently needs to happen. But once that processing's done, we talked to the organizers of the crowdfunding effort, and they agreed that donating it to charity was the best way to go. So we're going to be donating a third of it to the Red Cross to support relief efforts in BC. We're going to be donating a third of it to the Calgary Women's Emergency Shelter, because this month is Family Violence Prevention Month. And I have a very soft spot in my heart for the Calgary Women's Emergency Shelter, having organized benefit concerts for them for prior to COVID, well over a decade. And then we're also going to be donating a third of the money to Street Cats here in Calgary. For anybody who doesn't know, the Street Cats are a harm reduction outreach group. They're very, very grassroots. We have an episode that we're going to be releasing on them in about a week or so. And they were very generous with us. Not only did they sit down to have a conversation with us, but they also allowed us to go out and do a bit of a walk along on one of their outreach nights. And I got to tell you, it was one of the most
humbling experiences of my life, just the relationships that they have built with a lot of the houseless individuals who are trying to stay safe in Calgary. So it was a really, really impactful thing. It's going to make an amazing episode. I'm about halfway through editing it, and I'm really excited to be able to release that episode. But I'm even more excited that we're going to be able to use some of the funds from the attempt to get us into the UCP AGM to support the incredible work that they're doing, because contrary to what Mr. Kenny said during his keynote address, harm reduction is absolutely a critical component in dealing with not only addiction, not only houselessness, but the opiate crisis at large. So that's kind of the breakdown story for the AGM. But Sarah, you had your own little adventure. So before we get into the topics of the week that we want to talk about, why don't you go ahead and share that little story?
What a weekend. It was quite wild. So Deirdre, a few weeks ago, we spoke, we're like, okay, we're going to send media requests for women of AV poly. And Deirdre sends her requests, no answer. Then we kind of go through our back channels, people we know, and, you know, and they were like, well, we're not getting any answers back. They're probably a little hesitant of letting you in. So we're hearing other media did not get their response back. So we're like, okay, well, you know what? We're just gonna show up and register at the desk. So we wait in line. Then they kind of rushed us in a little bit because the anti-vaxxer crowd was coming in front of the building at the convention center. So they did check my vax board. We got checked, and they were like, oh, media, the table's over there. So we gave her names. They're like, oh, no, you're not on the list. He was like, but that's okay. Just write down your media outlet, your name. And then they gave us our passes. So we're walking around trying to feel the vibe in the room and, you know, trying to see who's there, who's not. And then we start walking different direction. And then one of the media guys runs after us. He's like, guys. He's like, I'm sorry, but I need to take your passes away. So we're like, okay. They were like, we don't recognize you as media. I look at him, I'm like, well, you know, we did send multiple emails and no one got back to us, hence why we decided to show up. So that's the story. So from what I understand and what I know, that the non-traditional medias that were let in were the one that were more, how could I say, we were, but the reasoning behind it is that we were biased and against the UCP because we are fairly critical of the current government, and basically we were not pandering to, you know, their base, and we were not really fitting the bill. So we had our passes around our necks for about 15 minutes. We had time to take a picture, walk around, feel the room a little bit, and then they were like, no. So we went next door and we went to have dinner.
Was it a good dinner, at least?
It was okay. It was, you know, it's casino buffet food. It's what you would expect.
Now, one thing I have to jump in and point out before you continue, yeah, Sarah, because I think it's really important. As much as here at the breakdown, we do some commentary, we certainly have broken some air quote stories, yeah, that the conventional media has not covered or didn't break themselves, but yes, we're very, 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 very clear about the fact that we're not journalists. I mean, we do a, yep, lot of commentary, we do some investigation, we do some satire, but we're not journalists, and no, that needs to be juxtaposed with what the women of AV Poly are, because I, without hesitation, would
Deirdre
say,
is a journalist.
There's
Deirdre,
no question.
She's fairly well known on the AV Ledge AV Poly hashtags. She's well known in the province. She's well respected. She's like me. We talk to both sides of the aisles. We really do. But it was quite surprising. And I looked at Deirdre. I was like, they figured out who we were. and somebody got the list and they were like, nuh-uh, those two are not going in. So it was quite interesting. Yeah, it was quite the evening. It's a good story.
Well, and I think it's also worth just highlighting as well that the what you and especially Deirdre, like Deirdre just appeared on CBC, I think it was a week ago, doing commentary.
Yeah, and I do French commentary on French CBC.
Yeah, exactly. So you guys have way more credibility than we do here, and they still refused you.
Yeah, and Deirdre is recognized, right? She did work for media outlets.
Well, she wrote for the Western Standard for a bit there too. So yeah, it's not like she's written for media outlets that don't have conservative leanings, let's say.
Yeah, so me, I might be considered more like an opinion person or a pundit, if you don't like to. Have I been critical of this government? Yes. But it was not just because it was not because I hated them. It's because that criticism was justified. And you and call the shots how they are. And yeah, they can't handle that.
I think the other piece of the equation that's particularly interesting is that while they did not want the incredibly biased color commentators on the left coming in, when you take a look at who appeared from the far right side of the spectrum,
Caillou was there.
So for anybody who doesn't get the joke, Kian Bexley recently, well, about a year ago now, I guess, left the Rebel and started his own independent, whatever it is.
With very big brackets.
Yeah. And he was able to get in and accredited. The Rebel was able to get in. So there were a lot of very hard-leaning right news organizations that are prone to as much, if not more so, hyperbole and editorial latitude than either Women of AV Poly or The Breakdown. And they were accepted in. I mean, to me the cherry on top was the fact that they
kicked out a podcast on International Women's Day.
Men's Day. Yeah. And they kicked out an all female politics podcast that specializes on politics in Alberta, and you guys were booted out. Like that just blows my mind on pretty much every level possible.
You know, we can't criticize their decision making as much as we want. But at the end of the day, we also need to remember that it was a private event and they can do whatever the hell they want. You know, when he took our passes away, it was like, well, you could have bought the Observer pass. I looked at it and I was like,
no, you couldn't.
No. And we were waiting on you guys. And, you know, at the end of it is what it is. And I'm not upset. Well, at the beginning, I was like, what the fuck is happening? Pardon my French. I was like, really? What is this? Like, we're not going to be condescending towards them. We're going to be live tweeting and observe what is happening in the room. Because really, if you want to be able to have good, insightful commentary about this government, you need to be in those conventions and understand how it's happening. Well, everything is happening in there.
Yeah. The other piece to me is that one of the disadvantages of the tack that they chose to take with this is it would have been very, very easy. I mean, it's not like they had any shortage of press secretaries present. It would have been very, very easy for them to have said, you know what, Women of AV Poly or The Breakdown, we're super glad that you guys are here, and Breakdown, we love that you gave us $1,000. So what we're going to do is we're going to have Timmy here, and he's going to stay with you the entire time to make sure you have the best experience possible. And had The Breakdown, we were going to be totally professional, to be clear. We weren't going to cause any trouble. But had we done anything that would have interrupted the flow of their thing or anything like that, had we broken any of the rules, then they would have had the opportunity to respond instantly, and B, they would have had the opportunity to say, well, you know, we tried, we let him in, and then they decided to do whatever, and it would have given them the moral high ground. But instead they just chose to say, you know what, we just don't like these people, and so we're just gonna not.
But it's like it's, like I told my husband, I was like, I was there for science. It's silly, but I really wanted to understand what was happening in that room. And if they would have been saying, you sit there in that corner, you do not move, I would have obliged.
Oh,
And I would have,
as would we.
yeah, exactly. We're not there to cause trouble. We're there to understand.
But it was moving away from that because we
Yes.
do only have an hour.
Yes, we do.
There was some fascinating things that happened at the AGM that I want to run by you. So to start with, there doesn't seem to be any word as to what the provincial board of the UCP is going to do with the letter for the 22 constituencies. On the
No.
first evening, they did have a vote about increasing the number from 22 to 27, and it was voted down by the
It was
membership. So the
57% in favor. They needed 75. Yes.
So they didn't hit that target. So the constitutional requirement to trigger a leadership review for the United Conservative Party remains at 22 constituency associations.
Yes.
And that has been met. But they didn't seem to address any of that at this AGM, unless I missed something. Did you catch anything?
No, I didn't catch anything. So we left at around 8:30. Well, we were on the casino side. So what I noted, what was funny is that it was the first point of order. The convention started. So you had Miranda Rosen talking, and then you had Mr. Milliken, and you had Ms. Savage. And then they jumped right into voting. What was interesting is that while we were eating and kind of following what was happening next door, there was a lot of delegates in the buffet line up to go eat. And then we walked by and they're like, oh, what's happening in there? I was like, well, they're voting. They're like, yeah. I have a feeling that a lot of people didn't bother voting. But then after that, the convention got pretty vanilla, if we can describe
I
it
think we
that
can.
way. Yeah, it was pretty vanilla. But I don't know what they're going to. I strongly believe that because Mr. Kenney left this convention feeling stronger than earlier months, I strongly believe that he's going to try to delay it as much as he can towards the spring. Is this his last stint as a leader? Most likely. But we shall see. But again, it was voted down and then they moved on. There was nothing else to it.
But
So we'll see.
Saturday had a bit of an interesting,
Yes.
another interesting addition to the equation in regards to the UCP leadership. Brian Jean has made it clear that he's running on a platform to get the UCP nomination for McMurray, in order to replace Jason Kenney. We talked about that last week. But there's now a new name that has, I can't really say thrown her hat into the ring because it was a very sort of tentative, well, maybe I would if Mr. Kenney steps down or if Mr. Kenney's removed. And that is Danielle Smith, which is fascinating on a variety of levels because Danielle Smith has said for months and months and months that she would never run for public office again because she considers herself largely to be unelectable because of the floor crossing. But it looks like Mr. Kenney's behavior has lowered the bar in her perception enough that she is willing to come back and take another swing at it. Now, I got to be very clear, she didn't launch a campaign. She
No.
was asked by the Western Standard if she would consider it, and she said yes, if Kenny steps down, then I would. So it was sort of a non-launching announcement, I guess. What did you make of it?
It just show so basically what we could see is that it just shows that the UCP will not survive as it is right now. There's no way Ms. Smith would be able to be the glue between the more red Tory faction of the party and the more right wing membership. It could be a reboot of the Wild Rose, really, if we look at it. But again, we have Mr. Jean that was present this weekend as well. So you would have the two ex-Wild Rosers, two ex-leaders of the Wild Rose, coveting that seat, but would they be enough to keep everyone together? I do not believe so. So we would be facing another PC versus Wild Rose, then facing a vote splitting, then pushing the NDP to power. Again, we're back to vote splitting. And I know people don't like hearing vote splitting, but vote splitting does exist. It is an actual thing. It is real.
I got to be honest, I struggle with the vote splitting thing. I'm one of those people that doesn't like it. And the reason why I don't like it is because it portrays the idea of voting as only being allowed to go for, like, you can really only have vote splitting if you believe in a binary state for politics.
Yes.
And I think that what we're seeing with the further indications that the UCP are going to end up fracturing, there are a diversity of opinions and values, and whether or not you agree or disagree with them, it doesn't negate the point. But there are people who consider themselves conservatives who would definitely fall more on the progressive side of things, and there are people who consider themselves conservatives who fall definitely on the far, far right side of things. And I don't think you can call it vote splitting when the notion that you can have somebody who could represent both of those groups, or a party that can effectively represent both of those groups, we're seeing what happens when you try to do that. So I understand the thinking behind vote splitting, because, you know, we saw it in the municipal election as well, where people were talking about, you know, at City Hall, we're going to have either progressive or conservative candidates. And people were talking about, well, which progressive or which conservative candidate are you going to vote for? But I would argue there's a big difference between somebody, I'll use the ward that I live in, somebody like Ian McAnerin, who it was a progressive conservative type candidate, very financially conservative, but socially progressive. Whereas you juxtapose that with somebody who ran here like Brent Trenholm, who was very, 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 he would do very well with the Wild Rose crowd, I suspect. And I would argue that if you look at the vote share, he probably did.
Yes.
But it looks like, though, and it's interesting because all of the contenders to take over, who are looking to take over from Mr. Kenny, so far do tend to lean on the farther right. And we definitely did see the UCP take a bit of a turn towards the right with some of the policies that they voted to enact.
Yes.
And I think the biggest one that I want to talk about is I just want to hate people but get away with it policy. So I'm talking about conscience rights.
Yes.
So my understanding of conscience rights, and I'm going to get you to take a swing at this right after, is that basically what it is it allows healthcare professionals to say, I don't believe in this thing, whether we're talking about abortion, whether we're talking about healthcare for members of the LGBTQ2S+ community, particularly trans, mm-hmm. whether we're talking about other factors. What the idea behind conscience rights is that it would allow a healthcare practitioner to say, my personal beliefs don't believe that abortion mm-hmm. is something that I should be supporting. So I should not have to perform an abortion or even write a referral to someone for a physician who would consider that,
mm-hmm.
Which has huge implications, because when you're talking about conscience rights being inflicted on people, we're talking about people who historically have had some of the biggest obstacles in accessing healthcare. And the UCP voted to support conscience rights.
Yes.
So A, am I explaining it okay? And B, what do you make of this direction that it's not a new direction for the party, but they did when Dan Williams, who's an MLA up north, tried to present it in the legislature, it was shut down pretty effectively mm-hmm. and it's back from the dead.
So obviously women will be paying the price of that motion, unfortunately. Trans people will be paying the high price for that motion. People, abuse victims will be paying the high price for this motion. The way the system is set, so yes, you're right, but you're a little wrong. So basically,
wouldn't be the first time.
It's okay. Abortion access, let's say in Calgary, does not require a physician's referral. That's number one. You can call. So there's, I will not name the clinics, just for, you know, safety reason. So you can call them. They will be asking you questions and they will give you an appointment. Then where it could get iffy is at the ultrasound, because what happens, so just so people know, I was a healthcare professional before my career, so I understand how everything works in the background. So basically, before someone that gets prepared for an abortion goes for a dating ultrasound. So depending on the weeks that you are, depending on how many weeks you're pregnant, they date the fetus. And then the procedure will be different coming with the age of the fetus. Then you have a number of weeks that is at the maximum where you cannot perform, legally perform an abortion anymore. So that side is, so that side is fairly safe. The only issue that could be done is if the person that is doing the ultrasound is not okay performing the dating for the person to go get an abortion. Now, the other, the, so that, that side is fairly safe. Women have the capacity of picking up the phone. They do a pregnancy test. They pick up the phone. And then they make their own appointment. No physician referral needed. The second part of it is, let's say if a teenager shows up, 17, 18, 19, or even a 35-year-old woman shows up in emergency, I mean, like, I had an oopsies last night. We did not use protection. I need plan B. Some doctors could refuse to prescribe it, but again, you are able to get it in pharmacy. Now, for the trans people, for the trans community, that gets more complicated because we have seen the example with Anna Murphy the other day where she had issues accessing proper pharmaceutical care and they wanted to refer her to a different pharmacy. They refused to serve her. So that's where I wouldn't say it's in the abortion portion as specifically that could cause issues. It's more in the day-to-day medical acts that we are going to see issues. Let's say if my family doctor would be against birth control because he doesn't believe in birth control, then I would be forced to go seek another medical professional. But then again, we would have to look at the motion if the doctor would be forced to refer to a different doctor, or he does not, or he or she does not have to do the referral because they refuse to provide the service needed. That is going to be interesting to see.
Yeah, the way that the policy reads is that physicians shouldn't even have to provide referrals. Yeah. But and I think you're right. In major centers like Calgary and Edmonton, there are, for a lot of people, additional options for how they can access services. But I think about a kid living in like Wainwright, or a woman living in Wainwright, yeah, or a trans person living in Wainwright, and they go to see their family doctor to say, hey, this is the thing that I'm trying to navigate, whether it's pregnancy, whether or not it's hormone therapy,
yeah,
top surgery,
can you help me? Yeah.
And if that physician says, you know what, that's, I don't believe in that stuff, I don't believe that's right, then that person now is in a position where they could potentially have to be traveling for a significant amount of time, assuming they have the resources to do that, in order to get the care that they need. And that's where it gets really quite dangerous, because, you know, I'll throw my candid hat in here as well. And then I actually want to, we have somebody who's requested to speak, so I want to go to them before we move on to the next topic. But you know, I work as a paramedic, and I'm a firm believer that the decisions made in healthcare absolutely have to be based on evidence. And if we have healthcare providers at any level, whether we're talking about paramedics or nurses or physicians or whatever, who are presented with a patient who is asking for care, and that healthcare provider now has the latitude to say, not based on evidence, not based on science, not based on what's in the best interest of the patient, mm-hmm. but on their own personal, moral, or religious feelings, I don't believe in the thing that you want to try to do or explore, so I'm just going to shut you down and not provide you any care.
Yeah.
That's incredibly problematic.
It is. But also, somebody that is listening to our Twitter space right now tagged us. CUP Alberta yesterday was saying, what would UCP delegates think of doctors who refuses to treat unvaccinated people who contract COVID? So that that motion opens a whole Pandora box. It's problematic through and through.
Yeah. This should be good. I'm looking forward to hearing what Payman has to say. So Payman, I've given you the mic. You should be able to speak now. For anybody who's unfamiliar, Payman used to be a press secretary in the UCP government, and we actually had him on for an episode about, I'm going to say a year and a half ago now, and he has raised his hand. So Payman, if you unmute your mic, what do you got to say, my friend?
Hey, thanks for having me on, guys. I have one question regarding the topic you're discussing right now, but I do want to point out from my previous experiences at UCP AGMs, there does seem to be more passionate people that attend many of these AGMs.
Yes.
And these passionate people tend to take the politics to the extremes, regardless of what party you're in. And the disconnect between the elected representatives at those AGMs and the members is very clear and obvious.
Yes.
When compared to their normal ones. So sometimes at AGMs, you see policies passed that don't generally reflect the core membership, but reflect the very extremes of your members. So, and that's why you'll see politicians sometimes step in and say, there's no way that we'll pass this. Some of the more, I'll call them extreme policies that are passed, don't generally make their way into government. They just seem to kind of die off on the paper within the party.
Yes.
Now, specifically for the topic you guys are discussing, I think the vast majority of these conscious rights aren't specifically geared towards the abortion side. I'm sure there are some that see that, but I think it's because of the introduction of physician-assisted suicide, which can compel a physician to essentially assist somebody in killing themselves if they choose to take that route. And I think that's the bigger impact, I guess, that is behind this policy.
Well, I got to jump in on two things there, Payman, because you've opened a door for me to do it, so I'm going to walk right through it. There were, and you have a little bit of insight, so I'm going to ask you to speak as to whatever level you're comfortable, but there were multiple reports leading up to the UCP AGM from inside the UCP, as well as outside of it, of Jason Kenney and the Premier's office making a very strong, concerted, coordinated effort to ensure only the policies that he wanted to see brought forward and that the caucus wanted to see brought forward would be brought forward. So in the absence of that sort of orchestration, I could totally wrap my head around how you know, you get these policies that are brought forward from the more extreme fringes of the party. But given that it was so widely reported that the policies that were brought forward were extremely controlled, I got to ask, like, is it really that disconnected from the core of the direction that certainly the Premier's office wants to take things?
Well, I can't say that I know 100% the answer to your question, but I could say there's a lot of rumors that occur in social media platforms. And also you can see one of the first motions being calling for a review to Jason Kenney's leadership, showing the clear disconnect between some of the leadership in several of the constituency associations and the leader's office. And I think if it was up to him, it's unlikely that they would present that motion and see it, you know, 50% vote in favor of. Perhaps if he was in control, the Jason Kenney that I know would have saw that either fail or it wouldn't come up as one of the first few policies to discuss anyway.
Okay. And I will say to what you were talking about with the MAID program, and I think it's important to delineate that while some people like to call it assisted suicide, the medical terminology is MAID or medical assistance in dying. That's very much another referral program. So when you're talking about patients who are looking to access MAID, somebody can't just walk into the GP's office and say, hey, I'd like to go now. It is a very, very exhaustive process to ensure that only people that meet certain criteria are able to access the program. But even then, when they do, it's a medical procedure that's performed in a medical facility by physicians who are choosing very much to be in that role. So when we're talking about physicians or any other medical personnel being air quotes forced to do something that they don't want to do, that's not a possibility with the current system. The most that any physician, family doctor, whatever the case may be, would have to do would be to provide a referral. And that referral is explicitly named in the policy procedure. So it's not just about whether or not physicians have to perform the procedure themselves. It's about specifically whether or not a physician would have an obligation to provide a referral for a service that they're not comfortable themselves providing. So I just wanted to make that delineation there. And you said you had a question as well, Payman.
No, I asked my question. It was regarding that. That's not necessarily my views. That's just, I believe the presumption behind the motion was more related to this MAID program than it was to do anything abortion or affecting specific healthcare rights for trans people.
Okay. I think it would be very interesting to see what the actual legislation would potentially look like, because certainly the legislation that Dandy Williams presented when he first did his conscious rights, which is a joke that I'll never get tired of making, it was definitely written in a way where marginalized communities definitely could have a more difficult time accessing healthcare. And that to me is extremely problematic. I don't think there's very many people who would argue that when we're talking about elective scheduled procedures, the best place to perform those procedures is in clinics that are operated by physicians. I mean, like, there's a reason why pediatricians exist. There's a reason why oncologists exist. And it's very alarming to me, the notion that anybody would have their ability to simply have a referral limited because of not evidence-based reasons, not science-based reasons, not medical-based reasons, but personal preference. That's a very, very dangerous road to go down, I think. For me, anyways, that's my take on it. So, Sarah, moving on. I know we have a little bit of a tough timeline with you because we've got a hard 8 o'clock wall.
Yeah, sorry.
And I'm going to leave K, whoever K lots of E's is. I'm going to leave your mic on. So if you want to jump in, then by all means, feel free to jump in and we'll make space for you. But the other couple of things that I wanted to talk about specifically with you, Sarah, is there was a big announcement at the beginning of the week that was wonderfully awkward, mm-hmm. where Mr. Kenney announced with Justin Trudeau the new childcare deal for Alberta. This is the $10 daycare program that a lot of people have been waiting to see Alberta get some traction on, and it hadn't happened until I think it was Monday. But there's some catches to it. So before we get into the catches, what did you make of the announcement, Sarah?
So the childcare announcement, lots of caveats into it. It is bad that it is set on enrollment and not capacity. It is unfortunate to see that there won't be really the childcare workers won't be really getting any benefits out of it on a financial standpoint, because let's be honest, they raise our kids. How does it make sense that a child that would require 2 or 3 hours of care a day, the parent will have to pay more than a child that will have that requires full-time daycare? That to me is a little weird. Just for an example, right now for my youngest, we pay $1,200 a month for her to go to daycare. My cost might be reduced by half. We don't know when, hopefully in the next 3 months, but we don't know when, but it does not, how they've forgotten a class of parents. If you want to put it that way, it's only if they check, they looked at the assignment, they said, okay, early childcare education funding, they checked the box, and they forgot a whole part of that childcare, which is before and after school. Why would a parent pay $700 or $800 a month for part-time care? Why?
Well, this is one of the big problems that certainly the opposition has jumped on, because the NDP critic raised immediately the concerns that, again, you just said there, the fact that there's no out-of-school care. So if you're a parent who wants to work, which is the whole premise behind having the affordable childcare, if you're a parent who wants to work, then you're put in a position where if your kids are in school, you do not get access to this program as it currently is. If your kids require, like if you're scheduled to work till 5 and your kids are out of school at 3:15, now you have to find at full price care for your kid from 3:15, whether it's through an after school program or whatever the case may be. You have to find care for your kid from 3:15 until you're able to get home and do the parent stuff again. And so that really does put a crimp, because when we're talking about after school care, there's a lot of places that run half day programs for things like kindergarten. Yeah. And so if a parent chooses to send their kid to kindergarten, they'll get the 3 or 4 hours in the morning or the afternoon where their kid's in school. But if they then need to put their kid in childcare after that, you're SOL.
Yeah.
So there's some pretty big gaps in it. But the other one that you mentioned was the funding based on the enrollment, not spaces. Mm-hmm. So if you're a preschool, and so we're not talking about public school, we're talking about preschool. If you're a preschool and you operate a facility that has the capacity to have 50 kids in it, you've got a bunch of different classrooms, let's say, you do not have the ability to access the funding from this program until all 50 of those spaces are filled. And when we're dealing with something like COVID, where we're seeing a lot of parents who are very reluctant to put their kids in these programs and instead, for not only financial reasons but health reasons, choosing to keep their kids at home, then you're not really providing any assistance to these facilities. No. Because if they aren't able to get 50 kids in there, then they don't get
the I'll give you an example. My daughter's daycare, they have I think it's 100 capacity. I believe it's 100 kids. Right now, they're at around 85. So, and that is the issue. And I always said, it's always in the fine print. Yes, we're happy this is happening, but there's always a but. And you always need to read the fine print, because there will always be a deceptive point into their programs that they're bringing to the table. That, not like if they're, like if we're feeling like they're half, and pardon my French again, half-assing the assignment, but they're doing it, but kind of reluctantly, because they're putting their own convenience into it. So again, because it's based on occupancy, on attendance, when will we see that money?
Yeah, it doesn't really provide a lot of stability.
It does not provide stability. Like for me, when I decided to put she's one now. When I decided to put my child in childcare, it was an extremely hard decision, because you're worried about COVID. They cannot be vaccinated. I'm very fortunate they have really, really good protocols where she's going. But again, there's a lot of parents who, I'm a working mom, so my child had to go to daycare. But there's a lot of parents that can't stay or choose to stay home because of that situation. So again, we're going to be at this disadvantage where families will be left out again, and we're going to be left hanging because we do not know when we will see that money.
It definitely seems like they could have done a much better job structuring the deal. And it almost strikes me that the deal was put together in a way that they could say, look, we got a deal, as opposed to, look, we got a deal that's going to make sure that any parent, and I think it's really important here to recognize that when we're talking about who is disproportionately affected by not having access to affordable childcare, we're talking about women. So this deal doesn't seem to have been structured in a way that's focused on how do we make sure that women who want to have the ability to get back into the workforce, because there's a tremendous economic gain to that. It doesn't look like that's what the motivation for the deal was. It looks like the motivation for the deal was, well, I guess we have to have a deal because people are getting real angry about this. But before we get, like, again, I know we've got that hard deadline of 8 o'clock for you.
I have Dr. Cooper here.
Okay.
That Stephanie Cooper. I know Dr. Cooper because she is the one that catched Maddie when she was born. She has requested to talk.
Oh, let's make that happen for
you. Yes, let's hear Dr. Cooper. I love Dr. Cooper. She's great.
Hey, Dr. Cooper, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no, thank you.
Hi.
Hello. No, a great discussion. But I think, you know, this makes me think that, I mean, once again, a Band-Aid solution. But, you know, bigger picture is that, you know, we have to recognize overall how do we both, you know, facilitate women. And again, it's mostly women coming back into the workplace with not just affordable, but flexible childcare and family-focused childcare that, you know, I work with so many nurses, for example. They work 12-hour shifts often at night. You know, it doesn't matter if there's supplements for pay if it doesn't work overall in terms of a structure that, yeah, facilitates women. And not just the, you know, the 12-hour shifts being the time that needs, you may need to have coverage for, you know, childcare, but the idea that we need to change the way that new and new parents and, like, you know, not just women, but men too, work, so that, you know, a 12-hour shift is maybe not the right way for a new parent who has young children, that maybe that's not the best way of doing things. Maybe we need to have more job splitting. Maybe we need to have you know, a recognition of more ways to have, you know, working from home or whatnot in that. So just saying, okay, we're just going to, you know, supplement the cost of childcare for young, you know, young children is also not recognizing the many other issues that are, you know, potentially preventing women from getting back into the workforce and enhancing their career and their professional satisfaction while still feeling like they are meeting their parenting goals as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to ask Dr. Gruber, what would that, in a perfect world, what would that shift look like to you? What are the things that you would want to see a provincial government step forward with and say, this is what we're going to do to make sure that the people who want to work can, and people who want to work a little bit also can?
Well, I think it's not about whether they want to or not want to work. It's about finding work structures and support that are best suited to each family's needs. So that, you know, if you have a teacher, for example, that, you know, potentially they have childcare during, you know, the hours that they are teaching, but they also have support for the admin duties that they require after hours. So it's, and I think, again, back to nursing, is saying is that, well, you know, you a 12-hour, especially shift work with, you know, young kids at night is really, you know, year after year is really challenging. So it's more of saying, let's rethink the way that people work. Mm-hmm. And I know this is a pie in the sky idea, but I see so many amazing nurses, as an example, leave, you know, the critical sort of on hospital based intense working because it doesn't work for their families.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, again, perfect world. I see so many amazing women who delay their careers or maybe not put the time and energy into their careers because their work does not recognize the needs of, you know, of them as a parent too. And if we just shifted that, we could maybe change, you know, yeah, everything.
Wait, well, what's interesting, Dr. Cooper, is that when I was practicing nursing back in Quebec, our shifts were 8 hours. It was split in three shifts, 11 p.m. to 7 a.m., 7 a.m. to 3, 3 to 11. So that way they were more, it was easier. Well, I didn't have kids on time because I was 20 years old, but there were more ways for us or for, you know, the women were working as nurses to be able to be more of a present parent, to be able to spend more time at home with their kids and not get home, just be plain exhausted.
And I think that's exactly it. Women yeah. already are feeling guilty. And again, it's not just women, but we have to recognize the majority of the times it is women. You know, they're already feeling guilty for not being there. And
yes.
then, you know, maybe not, you know, this constant battle when, and I, you know, the same thing for me when my kids were young. But one of the best examples of something that was done right was, and this doesn't happen, it's not facilitated, but I did know of two nurses who 20 years ago managed to basically create the perfect job share. And and they actually helped the childcare of the other, you know, the other nurse. And mm-hmm. so, you know, there should be maybe more of that, and maybe more job shares for teachers, more job shares for nurses, for physicians, everything is to say, you know, at certain times we should change the way the traditional role is set and the work hours are set to actually be family focused. And that's going to make for better employees, happier parents, and overall better productivity and, you know, women's place in the workplace. You know, so I just think it's a creativity of thinking, how do we do things differently?
Yeah.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing that, because it actually dovetails quite nicely with the episode that we just released this morning, where we had a conversation with a teacher, an entrepreneur, an advocate, Andrew Willman, who is a teacher up in Grand Prairie. She's a substitute teacher predominantly now. And the biggest reason why she shifted to substitute teaching was because the structure within the education system is such that she was not able to do all of the things that she wanted to do. And all of the things that you just listed off there, Dr. Cooper, are things that she described in that episode. And I know I'm wandering into shameless plug territory, but I'm going to do it real quick just before Sarah has to bail. It really is a powerful episode. And I was quite surprised with the way that the conversation went when I started the conversation with Andrea, because it started in one place and then it went to a bunch of different areas in regards to the new high school curriculum that I never would have thought of. And they're very, very real areas of concern. So for anybody who's looking to kill an hour off, I would definitely encourage you to take a listen to that. Real quick, just before I have to let Sarah go, I just want to talk about what she was referring to earlier.
Yes, which I'm sorry. I'm so sorry.
It's all good. So we're talking about the Sonia Savage made a big thing this week about celebrating the fact that there are some Métis groups that are fighting a tanker ban on the West Coast. And those Métis groups are using funding that's coming from the Alberta provincial government to fight for tankers, which to me is wildly entertaining, because Sonia Savage has complained at length about people interfering with Alberta's energy process. But here we are, Alberta, funneling money into BC to affect their environmental issues. Sarah, real quick before you have to go, what's your take on that whole situation?
It's just bad. It is so bad. It is cherry picking. They are, again, trying to work with what works for them or whomever. It's extremely frustrating to see that they will not reach out to the provincial Métis group in regards to that matter, and that they are cherry picking two Métis administrations, if we can call them that way, to go to court for them. That's the way I see it. They're going to court for the Alberta government. I'm making speculation, but that is my personal opinion. They're taking public funds to go fight a bill that they disagree with, but they don't want to be the forefront of that fight. I feel like they are. Could we say that? Would it be okay for me to say that and feel that maybe they're using them a little bit?
Well, it certainly seems like they're using them as a proxy.
Yeah, they're using them as a proxy to go fight that fight and to justify the use of public funds. Oh, look at us. We are in association with some Métis groups. We're going to go fight that. But really? What's the intent here? Is that kind of a little bit of a firewall that they're trying to create? And twist the narrative after that. If it fails in court, say, well, see, they rejected Métis groups. It's going to be interesting to see the spin they're going to be doing on that one. It's going to be extremely interesting.
I totally agree. Yeah. Sarah, I know you have to go, so I want to say thank you so much for making the time again. And we will see you next week.
I will be around.
I guess next week.
Yes.
So first of all, I want to thank everybody who came out to listen. And anybody who is listening, just a reminder that we will be doing this next week, and we will also be releasing the audio from this conversation as a special edition of one of our podcasts. That'll be up tomorrow morning. As always, I would be remiss if I didn't remind everybody that we do have a Patreon page, and a big part of what enables us to be able to do all of the things that we're trying to do is our Patreon support. So if you have the money for a cup of fancy coffee, a week that you can spare, or actually a month that you can spare, because our entry level is $5. Not only do you get early access to all of our episodes, but we have some perks that we give for our longtime supporters as well. And it really does make a huge difference into what we're able to do, because we really are looking at upping our game in a big way. Big thank you to especially Sarah again for co-hosting this whole thing with me and doing all the heavy lifting on these things, and a big thank you to everybody for coming out and listening. And I just want to say again, the episode that we released today on the curriculum review is such an important episode for people to hear. It's part two of a three-part series that we're doing. The third part will be coming out at the end of this week, and then the next episode that we'll be releasing after that will be on the Street Cats, which are the harm reduction outreach group. And boy, that one's a doozy. I'm really, really excited to get it out. So hit up our podcast page. We're available everywhere that you listen to podcasts. Feel free to send us a DM, and we will see everybody here at the same time next week. Thank you so much, everyone.